Stronger than expected unemployment numbers are out. How do they impact the economy and the markets?
This is Jerry Toome with Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Toome. This is Michael Williams. Well, Jerry, you know, we've been in and out of vacations, and the market's been in and out with Santa Claus coming in. But what have you been seeing since we got back now in January? So what's been going on in the market the past few weeks?
Well, I have to first of all admit that I took a couple of weeks off, and I just barely even watched anything for the last week of December and the first week of January just to take a break. But, I mean, right now, I'm not liking what I'm seeing in the market. It's very interesting. The bulk of the information we had, and of course, you know, we wrote a newsletter last September about election blues, which talked about the fact that we thought we were right on the verge of a recession based on all the leading indicators. And of course, Trump tumped the entire apple cart over on that one, because the Trump victory, which not only, you know, I think it was debatable. My gut feeling, like I said, was I thought he was going to win, but I didn't expect him to win with such numbers and such a overwhelming majority compared to his previous win and his previous loss. Essentially, the market had a massive party. I'm looking at a chart here on ETF flows, record 50-day ETF flows, and it goes back to, you know, ETFs have not been that popular, exchange-traded funds, since about the middle of this chart goes back to 2015. And you had a big surge in 21, you had a big surge in 22 at the peak of that market in 2022. It's off the charts. It's almost double what it was at the top of the market in 2022. If you look at some of the other pieces of the market right now, ebullience has just kicked in. So I'm reading a newsletter. Ned Davis is one of our favorite analysts. We've added him recently in the last year or so. Ned Davis Sr. has a great book out, by the way, and I'm looking at it. I'm doing this from home today with the snow, but the title of the book is Being Right or Making Money, and this is the third edition. I would get that book if I were had anything to do with being an active trader. But anyway, he should
follow that up for marriages about being right or being happy.
All right, I won't comment on that one. But anyway, this is from late December, and the title of it is Sentiment Valuation Bubble. Bubble? Bubble can be a dangerous word here. So I'm looking at a couple of things on this, his charts. Number one, record high consumer expectations for rising stock prices. Now, if you are in somewhat of a bubble, and I think we are in somewhat of a bubble right now, not as severe as the 2000 market with dot-coms, but a lot of the expectations I think have just gotten out of reason. Record high expectations for rising stock prices. This is from the conference board. Their attitude towards stocks. The latest shows a record bullish outlook on stocks, which is historically, think about it for a moment, be a contrarian here, historically been bearish for stocks. Now, let me explain that. But let me first of all give you, all I can do is describe for radio what the chart looks like. But the chart goes back to 1987, and it shows essentially, remember this, when everybody is expecting stocks to go really high, and the percentage of negative or bearish advisors shrinks down to a very minimal amount, what that usually means is that everybody's fully invested. The bulls have taken over, they're running, and the ebullience and the emotions of it have driven stocks to unsustainable peak. The question is it a short-term peak or a long-term peak? And the answer is yes, we don't know. It's too early to tell if it's a short or long-term peak. Right now, if you just look at the economy and you look at the Trump thing, and by the way, I want to say that I'm very bullish about Trump's effect on the economy and the changes he's planning on making. I think It's obviously going to be a rough sledding. I hope that Elon Musk and Vivek are going to be effective at their Dodge program of, you know, making the economy more efficient. I'm not holding my breath on how much they're going to be able to cut, though. There's entrenched interest everywhere. But when I'm looking at this record high expectation for rising stock prices, part of this is ebullience based on the election results. People were thinking, oh, we're going to have a disputed election. Kamala might win. They're pretty sick of what happened with Biden. They don't think Kamala's going to change anything. So really, mostly the hardcore left wingers are the ones that voted for her. I don't think many of the people in the middle did at all. And that's clear based on the number of states that he won. But the record number of bullish people over the next 12 months, it's off the chart. Literally, it's one third higher. And again, this chart goes back to 1987. It's one third higher than it's ever been since 1987. Historically speaking, when it's just above, you know, the top bar, which is at 40, the annual gain from there is usually 0.12. So in other words, when everybody gets too ebullient and they're too enthusiastic about stocks and they're saying, hey, I think stocks are all going to go. And it's the old analogy we've used over and over and over again about people, too many people lining up on the same side of the boat and the boat tumps over. When you get to extremes and what we call sentiment, and we're going to talk about breadth today, sentiment and valuation for the market. When the sentiment gets to in a record extreme, which it is right now, again, quoting Ned Davis verbatim, the Conference Board surveys consumers about their attitude towards stocks. The latest survey shows a record bullish outlook on stocks, which, again, understanding on a contrarian basis, has historically been bearish for stocks. Let's talk about contrarian sentiment for just a moment, contrarian behavior, because a lot of people don't understand that, you know, used to when I was first starting out in the industry, you'd hear people say, well, contrarians, you know, the market is wrong when you reach, bottom line is it, when it reaches major inflection points, the sentiment or the bullishness or bearishness of the market is wrong. Now, in the middle of the move, so if you take a bell-shaped curve, let's say you've got the bottom 20%, the top 20% bell-shaped curve, in the middle of the move, the majority is right, whether it's bullish or bearish, whether you're in a bear market or bull market. The issue is when you reach a hinge point in the market, either bull or bear, then that's when the majority is wrong. And that makes you what Templeton called it, the point of maximum optimism. We might be at that point. I'd say it's too early to tell right now. I'm not going to get hardcore bearish on this right now at this point. So I still think that there's a possibility. I was listening to a new strategist. We've had Strategus, and they're really good charter market technicians out of Washington. They deal with the political stuff as well. They're projecting single digit returns for the year. 13% is what the market is expecting for earnings growth. That's what the consensus on Wall Street. They think it's going to be more like 9% earnings growth. That's assuming no major shocks to the system. That's just assuming the current trends continue as they are. But the latest survey, again, according to Ned Davis Sr., when you have a record bullish outlook on stocks, that historically has been bearish for the market. So I'm not necessarily saying I'm bearish at this point, but I am very cautious at this point. Margin trading went off the charts again. In November saw a $75 billion surge in margin borrowing to a 12-month high of almost $900 billion. And record in inflows into ETFs. Like I said, the inflow in 50 days was a parabolic curve. And that's one of the things that you learn to look for in the markets, Michael, is you learn to look for parabolic moves. When you see a parabolic move, it could be a short-term parabolic move. Like I remember very well when we had COVID, the market had a big tank in a little over a month. And I still remember there's an ETF that we use from time to time that deals with long-term government bonds. That thing had a parabolic move up, and we were fortunate. We bought it before it went up, and we sold it within a day of the top. But the bottom line is those parabolic moves indicate danger. So right now, I would not say that I'm necessarily a bear. I think I would be very bullish long-term for what I think Trump is likely to do for the economy and the markets over the next 4 years. The question is, are we going to get some sort of a black swan event, Have we got to the point of maximum optimism, as Templeton would say? And I say the jury is out right now. I'm not going to say that we have, but I'm not going to say we haven't. And so this market action is making me increasingly concerned. Usually when you have the Santa Claus rally, which we talked about in depth before we took the break there, Santa Claus, he didn't exactly have coal in the stocking, but he did in the second half of the month. And January has not started out real well. That's right.
He didn't give us anything exciting.
Nothing exciting. That's right. So we essentially had a peak in the market in mid-December, and then negative market action for the most part the rest of December and the first part of January. That's not really a good way to start the whole market for the next 9 to 12 months. So,
well, I'd say it's pretty consistent with our money managers, with our researchers, and with our own in-house chartered market technician, David McCord. They're all kind of in a wait and see mode.
Yeah.
They're talking very similar to you. They still have a positive, big picture positive outlook, but they're worried about sentiment, valuation, and something we're going to get into a little bit later. Inflation is a common theme with everyone.
It is. And if we're drilling down a little deeper on the stock market part, we had record run of bad breadth again. So three of the things you want to normally watch about the market: the breadth of the market, that's how many stocks are going up divided by how many are going down. So you want to see a healthy bull market is the rising tides lifting all the boats. When a bunch of the boats are starting to sink, that's usually not a good sign. In December, we had a record run of bad breadth, 14 consecutive days where declining stocks outnumbered advancers. That's the longest since 1972. Mm-hmm. That's a long time. Now, 1972, again, was what most people don't remember. That was a period of time where the market had a humongous bear between the top of the market in 1972 and the bottom of the market, which was at the end of December of 1974. So that bad breadth, that advanced decline line, gave you a lot of warning. Basically, it turned over in 72 before the market really did, and then you had a record bear market. That was almost as bad as 2008 for that generation of people. So last year had a great year for technology, for communications, but a lot of the things that didn't do well, energy, discretionary staples, financials, utilities, those had one of the worst periods of time, one of the worst years that we've seen in the last 20. Materials, healthcare, and real estate was the worst in the last 20 years. Again, this is according to Ned Davis. Basically, the second strongest for technology, the 1998 to 2000, was the only one that had higher numbers on technology. And of course, that was the top of the dot-com bubble, and you had a massive bear market after that. So we're now at a point where the top 10 stocks in the market are now, according to Ned Davis, 39% of the capitalization of the S&P 500. That is also a record. And again, we don't know what could trigger this, but we do know that historically speaking, when you get the market where the gains are that concentrated in one little corner of the market, that is normally a bad sign for the market not too far out. So right now, I don't see a huge drop in earnings at this point. The two major bears we had, one in 2000 and one in 2008, there was a sharp drop in earnings prior to the bears hitting. So the good news is that's not happening right now. Consumers are feeling a lot wealthier. The wealth effect from the market being up last year and real estate holding its gains, especially if you're in residential real estate, not necessarily commercial real estate, but the wealth effect from people's own personal homes and the stock market is very strong. That should carry us into the year economically. But essentially,
I do want to mention, you brought up commercial real estate. We have part of an interview we do with Adam Larson coming up in the second half of the show that will talk about multifamily on the commercial real estate. So just while that was fresh in my mind, I wanted to bring that up.
And that's true. We're going to talk to Adam again. And so anyway, the issue is everything right now across the board is pretty well worse than the top of the market in mid-December. So right now, would I say I'm a bear? Would I say I'm a cautious bull? I would say I'm probably a cautious bull. But if you push me very hard the other way, this is the kind of market that could turn bearish in a hurry. And what you don't understand is you have no idea what would trigger it. And that's kind of the way things are. When you hit a point of maximum optimism, if we are there, the point of maximum optimism, you never know what's going to be triggering the downside. So I'm not necessarily saying I'm bearish. I'm not saying that's going to happen this year. I'm saying there are a whole lot of warning flags out that are flying. And it's kind of reminds me of that book they had on the perfect storm a few years ago, where there are some major flags, major warning flags watching right now. And you got to be careful about what those things are saying. So in the short run, I'm cautious. In the long run, I'm bullish. Long run meaning between now and 2030, at least to Trump's administration in 2028, end of 2028. But it's at the same time, I think the market's gotten ahead of itself. And at the very least, we could have a period of consolidation. February is very oftentimes a period where the market completely reassesses the year. You oftentimes have rotations out of last year's winners into new things. Right now, I think the market's trying to reassess. The biggest factor is what's going on with interest rates. The Fed has started the rate cutting cycle. Normally speaking, once the Fed starts the rate cutting cycle, interest rates, you know, just start falling. And they keep falling until the Fed's done. In this case, the Fed started cutting interest rates and rates are going up again. So that's indicative to me that this is a little bit different. If you go back and look at the last 30 years, really the last 40 years, since Paul Volcker was in office in 1981, when he peaked out the prime interest rate at 21.5%, which I remember vividly. I was just getting started in the financial services industry. You could get money market funds at 19% back then. That's just shocking and amazing thinking about that. But since that point in time, you've seen ratcheting lower interest rates and inflation since Volcker did beat inflation that time. But at this point in time, we're in a different market environment. If you look at the economy and if you look at inflation, usually when inflation gets out of the bag, so to speak, it's kind of like opening Pandora's box, meaning it's not going to get back in that box very easily. And historically speaking, once you get one major surge like we've just had of inflation, it is almost always 9 out of 10 times it's followed by another major surge, which I don't think starts right away. I don't think that will happen this year, probably not even next year. But before now in 2030, I think you're going to have another round of inflation that could be worse than the one we've just experienced. And I think that that's what the bond market is looking at right now. There's a term that a lot of people are not familiar with called the bond vigilantes. And essentially what they've said was in the 1970s, the bond investors had not seen that kind of rising inflation. We had major inflation after World War II. We had some major inflation in the 50s, but the markets weren't near as sophisticated then as they are now, or even they were in the 70s. In the 70s, bond investors just got clobbered and they had their head handed to them again and again and again, year after year after year. There was a brief respite when the market pulled back in 1974. But for the most part, it was a disastrous period for bonds because we had high inflation in two huge waves. We actually had three. One wave started after the Vietnam War and during the acceleration of that with LBJ and the essentially the guns and butter. He was accelerating the war and he was also spending domestically. Medicare was invented and all that stuff. You had that first wave, then you had the second wave in the early 70s and the final wave that ended in 79-80. But the bottom line is if you look at history, past performance, no guarantee future results, there is a tendency for the market to tend to recur. Patterns of history tend to recur oftentimes. As Mark Twain said, they don't repeat themselves exactly, but they tend to rhyme. And so it looks to me like we're going to have a year or two of moderate inflation, not going back to the last decade, which was near deflation at, because we were coming out of the accident of 2008, but moderate inflation followed by another inflationary surge probably late this decade. So at this point,
I mentioned earlier that a lot of our researchers and managers are concerned about inflation. It's not that it's necessarily going to be high this year. It's that it's going to be higher than the market's expectations. Feels like the market's expecting us to go back to where we were, 2% or below.
Well, it was.
They're saying that's not really what they're seeing. And so that could cause some issues with pricing.
It is. And it's happening in the bond market. And that's feeding over into the stock market. So The Fed was on hold in December. It was a close call. Some of the members voted not to lower rates, but the majority decided to lower rates. It looks to me like they're on hold indefinitely right now. That might mean no more cuts this year, and that would be a shock to the market. Consumer confidence has been trending higher. The non-farm payroll came out at 256,000 for December. That's and it was broad-based, so we had a very good number on the employment. Unemployment actually fell to 4.1, back from 4.3 to 4.1. Wages still growing at 3.9. That is not exactly going back to 2% when wages are at 3.9. Initial jobless claims, that's when people first are laid off. That's flat. It's been flat for 18 months. Interestingly enough, Michael, though this is one of the things that's just kind of interesting. I got this from Strategus, one of our new data providers. The vast majority of jobs in terms of rising employment, can you guess where it would be?
Well, I'd be cheating because I already know the answers.
All right. The government is. The national government has 3 million people working for it, and it's rising. The state and local is not only rising, it's rising sharply. 5.53 million state employees, 15 million local employees in our country. So we're talking about 23 million people involved here. But if you look at where the strongest job growth is coming from, it's from government employees. Now, some people would make the case that's not exactly productive. I'd say that it is partially productive because those people still have jobs. They still buy groceries. They still buy cars. But you could also make the case that in some ways, government is somewhat of an economic parasite, so to speak. So in other words, it lives off the host. You're not generating wealth there as much as you are taking, you know, taxes and recycling that money. So anyway, I'm not going to get in a big diatribe about small government versus large or anything like that. But it's very interesting to me that outside of the healthcare sector, which makes sense because healthcare is, you know, going to keep healthcare spending is going to continue to rise as far as the eye can see the next 15 years, because the baby boomers, again, 76 million people born between 1946 and 1964 are getting older. And the healthcare costs are going to continue to rise. And there's no end in sight for that, at least for 15 years, until the baby boomers are kind of, you know, like the World War II generation. I saw a thing on Facebook recently, and if this was an accurate post, which you never know with Facebook, but if it was an accurate post, it said the last veteran of World War II who was 104 passed away. Okay, well, you know, at some point in time, the baby boomers will be like that. The last of the baby boomers, which I'm right in the middle of that group, will pass away, but that's not for at least 15 years, I don't think. So healthcare costs are going to continue to rise, but the fastest rising employment is state, local, and national government. That is not, the trend is not your friend there. So if you look at private employment, excluding education, which is also part of government, including medical and the government employees, private working is basically flat for the last 18 months. So we're not seeing an economic boom everywhere. We're seeing certain areas that are accelerating. Leisure is flat. Wage growth seems to be stabilizing about 4%. To me, that I don't see you getting wage growth back down where wages are rising at 2% a year. That was last decade's story. We're not going to see that this decade, I don't believe. And full-time employment is going sideways, been going sideways for almost 2 years. But interestingly enough, one of the stats that's interesting to me is that multiple job holders are climbing quite quickly. What that's telling us is that even though full-time employment is flat, in other words, it's been stable for the last almost 2 years after post-COVID, more and more people are getting more than one job. Why would that be? Because of inflation. Because they're finding, hey, I can't make my ends meet with one job, and I'm going out and getting more than one job. It also could be that they got laid off from their one full-time job, and they're holding multiple jobs. But the bottom line is that's not necessarily a really good trend. So I think the biggest factor that we're dealing with right now is the stock market is going to have to kind of come to grips, if you will, with how much interest rates are going to rise. Rising interest rates will be a headwind for the economy. bankruptcies, some of them may or may not be able to absorb higher interest rates. And I'm not trying to be a negative Nelly or throw bad news on a wet blanket on the good employment news that came out, but bankruptcies have been shooting up, not going up a little bit, just shooting higher, 14-year high on bankruptcies. What that tells us here is that there's a lot of people under extreme duress. That's not a positive for the economy. So am I saying that we only want to look at the glass half empty here? No, we're not. What I'm saying is it's one of those things you got to be careful of from time to time in the market. You do hit points of maximum optimism. The question is, have we done that or not? The answer is the jury is still out. I'm not going to make a call on that at this point. I want to see what happens over the next month or so in particular. Hopefully nothing wild, woolly, and crazy happens at the inauguration in Washington. And I do plan on being there, by the way. So the issue here is that we had a great year in the market last year. There was a great year in the market the year before. But the things that you look at that I would say, okay, what are the things that we normally look for that fuel major gains in the market, that mark those? Again, the breadth of the market right now is poor, not terrible, but poor, meaning you have, when you have only 55% of the stocks that I would characterize, if you use the 200-day moving average as a demarcation between a bull and a bear, which is pretty common usage in, you know, investment parlance, if you will, about 55% or above that. So a little more than half of the market is in a quote bull market. That means 45% of stocks are technically not in a bull market right now. That's not exactly a massive bull market. That is a market that is being driven primarily by the top 10 stocks, which again are now 39% of the market. So the breadth is weak, but not terrible. But we need to watch that. That's one of the things to watch for. Is the breadth going to get worse or is it going to improve? If the breadth improves, what that means is instead of everybody piling into the same stocks, the same 10 top 10 stocks in the S&P, it spreads out and it goes into the mid caps and it goes into other sectors of the market and consumer durables and all that kind of stuff. It doesn't stay primarily dominated by tech. The sentiment. Sentiment also hit extremes. That means people got too over-enthused about the market in the short run. Now, that's not necessarily a sell signal. It's a warning sign. It's like waving a red flag. Hey, watch out, caution here, because it could be a big problem. It's just we don't know yet. You have
to wait and see. Same story.
Go ahead.
Your analogy earlier, we were talking about in the boat, if we get too many on one side, right?
Right.
If you look at these professional racers, that they all will get to one side of the boat to make it lean on purpose to make it go faster around a corner. I kind of feel like that's where we're at right now with the sentiment, the valuations. That can be a good thing because they can go around the corner faster. But if something unexpected happens, it's an easy wipeout.
Yep. Yep. And it's a dangerous wipeout when it happens, too.
That's why we like to be tactical money managers.
Right.
Right. Because that way we could just keep an eye on this, because some of this sounds kind of contradictory to each other. And so we can kind of just kind of keep an eye on it. And if something does change, that's where we like to be able to change.
Yeah.
If the market starts tanking, we like to back out and be more defensive. If the market's doing well, we like to go in there and get what we can.
Absolutely. And so the issue is I'm still, at this point, I would say cautiously bullish about the year, but I got major, you know, I got my glasses on watching the risk tolerance, because it's one thing to go through just a short-term correction. It's another thing when, as I mentioned, looking at Ned Davis, and Ned Davis, to me, he's one of the top, you know, guys in the industry for the long term. Again, his book, Being Right or Making Money, to me is a classic. I get a copy of that if I have anything to do with trading whatsoever, if you haven't read it. When you get to the point where record high consumer expectations for rising stock prices, I mean, record high meaning all the way back to 1987, this is the highest it's ever been. But it's not only just the highest, it's 30% higher than the previous top. That indicates way too much ebullience in the market. That indicates the margin debt jumps, has a big jump in November and early December. and record inflows into ETFs, a parabolic curve. Those are the kind of things you watch to see, is this the top? It's too early to tell. I'm not going to say it is. I'm not going to say it's not. But I'm going to say, hey, this is, there are some significant issues to be aware of right now. It's not blindly bullish, in my opinion.
I've got a question for you that we haven't discussed before. One of our researchers, Alpine, made a comment. I may not get the terminology right, but he kind of called this a like a rolling recession, where it just seems to, it hits part of the economy, that part starts to rebound, it hits another part of the economy, it starts to rebound. With your economic background, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
I think there's some validity to that. I don't see a, we obviously haven't had a full-blown normal recession. We have seen the leading indicators, the front end of that curve, which is usually typically, once you see the beginning indicators, the leading indicators of the economy going down, the rest of the economy follows, but we just haven't simply seen that. If you go back and look at our newsletter we wrote in September, we showed once you start a breakout in the unemployment rate, it normally continues on. And that was a chart that went back over 50 years. We've never seen it stop right in its tracks and then start edging back down again. So the bottom line is we're seeing some very unusual economic numbers in terms of the types of things that I've never seen in my lifetime. And I've never, again, when you have a chart that goes back to 1948 and it's never done this before, that tells you, hey, last 13 out of 13 times prior when it did this, you had a recession. And right now we're not seeing that. It looks like we're going to have a reacceleration rather than a recession. And again, I would put a whole lot of that on Trump. If we hadn't had Trump, I think it's very easy to say that maybe we would have gone on into recession the first quarter or first half of this year. And we still could, because you never know what kind of shock might hit the system. But at this point in time, the shock is really not negative. The shock is positive in that the job gains are staying higher. The job gains are accelerating. The unemployment rate went down, not up. And the shock is that interest rates are rising back up. They may get where they were a couple of years ago, and that's going to put headwind against the market. And that's one of the reasons that the stock market is not liking what it's seeing right now, which is why it's retracing. So the question is, have we hit a top? Is this just a correction in a bull market? Right now, I would say the evidence is it's a correction in a bull market, but we have to be watching to see how that works, and we won't know until then.
All right. Well, before we move on to our interview with Adam Larson of Cottonwood about commercial real estate, specifically multifamily, I would like to remind you that you can learn more about us by going to cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. Again, there you can learn more about us. You can catch up on previous radio shows if you missed them. We also post interviews on there. Like recently, we had Mona Tuma on, I think just last week, talking about her book and her life story, which is amazing. If you haven't had a chance to hear that, I would recommend you go back and listen to it. We have our interview with Matthew Eich of U.S. Energy, talking about the outlook on the energy sector of the market and the economy, and just basically how does any of his views change now that Trump's won and going to be in office. It's a very, very good interview. Again, you can get Jerry's special reports there. He mentioned the latest one in September, where we talked about the election blues, about a possible bear market coming. Again, some of that is his views have changed since Trump won, but it's still solid information to keep an eye on. It's a good read. If you'd like to reach out to us for a free consultation, please call us at 1-800-327-4285. That's 1-800-327-4285. So before we start this interview with Adam Larson, I would like to mention that this is actually from earlier, a few months ago. I was going to say earlier in the year, but technically last year, during the summer. And so you might hear us mention things about the Fed, when they may start cutting rates. Obviously, they already have. But that's why the timing's just a little bit off on the conversation. All the information's still very pertinent to today, and that's why we wanted to play it for you again. All right, so let's go to our interview with Adam Larson of Cottonwood Communities. But before we do that, I do need to mention a little disclaimer that this is neither an offer to sell nor a solicitation of an offer to buy securities. An offer to sell any securities in Cottonwood Communities may only be made pursuant to a confidential private placement memorandum or prospectus as amended and supplemented. All right, Jerry, again, our focus is more the macro overview of his industry, not his specific products. So I'll let you go ahead and start the interview with Adam Larson.
Absolutely. We got Adam Larson. He's the Chief Financial Officer of Cottonwood Communities, folks we've known for well over a decade. And I'll just put it this way, my favorite guys in the apartment field, and apartments have been a long time. I remember interviewing one guy a long time back, several years ago, and he was taking some profits on apartments and moving to other sectors. This was a different type of real estate structure where they could go across different sectors. And he said, well, if I had to pick one sector of the marketplace forever, it would be apartments. So I'm not saying that's a guarantee. Obviously, it's clearly not. But we want to talk in more detail about what's going on with the apartment communities and what's going on with apartments, because you're getting all sorts of media backlash about, and there's truth to it, but is it overboard? You know, I think it is. I think there's a lot of things that are causing more angst about the apartment investment arena than it is necessary, really. So what we want to do is dive into this in a deep dive with Adam Larson, Chief Financial Officer of Cottonwood Communities. Let me start with my first question here. Now, we all know that real estate's been correcting, and we've had a down market since the Fed went on what was essentially the most aggressive rate hike cycle we've seen in 40 years. Now, most real estate types are down across the board. I'm showing apartments down about 30% from their highs as recently as the end of 2003. That's according to Green Street Commercial Property Index. Two primary factors seem to be at work here, and I'd like you to comment on this. First would be the pending oversupply. It happens in every cycle and every industry. When you get to the top of a cycle, people overbuild, overborrow, overleverage, or whatever. So first of all, we're going to have a pending oversupply. Best estimate, there could be as much as 1 million new multifamily units under construction in 2024. That's the highest since the 1970s, Bank Credit Analyst, May 2024. Secondly is the decline in the, quote, cap rates. And I want you to explain cap rates. The cap rates for real estate have been declining due to assumptions about future values. And I know, folks, we're getting very technical here, but I think you're going to understand this as this goes, and I think it's going to be a great interview. The cap rates for real estate are based on assumptions of future values on the real estate with this large run up in interest rates. All right, so two questions from that. I know this is a run-on question here. Number one, my sense is that we're probably at or near the bottom as interest rates appear to have peaked out for this cycle. I think that's becoming more apparent by the day. Number one, do you agree? And number two on that one, how do you think this could potentially affect property values? That's the first question. Question number two, apartment completions are the highest in over 40 years right now. We're seeing enormous demand, though, from millennials and Gen Zs moving into family formation. 127 million Americans, according to PwC, are estimated we have a housing shortage right now of 3.9 million housing units. So on the one hand, we have overbuilding in the short run. On the other hand, it appears we have a long-term shortage and a population boom. Would you please tell us what your perspective is?
Absolutely. And thank you for having me, by the way. I think it's helpful to jump back and provide a little bit of context into the just overall housing across the United States. And I'll go back to the great financial crisis when, as you mentioned, Jerry, in your question, right before the great financial crisis, we were at a peak of supply deliveries for all types of housing, single family, multifamily, and candidly, probably over delivering more than the demand that was available for housing, given some of the aggressive risk taking in the housing sector. You entered into the great financial crisis and bank regulators brought the hammer down on banks, inserted new regulations that effectively required banks to reserve higher capital against those loans that they were making in all types of real estate. You had a lot of developers going out of business. You had lending standards were increased and enhanced. No longer could you borrow without income verification. Down payments were increased. And effectively, the industry in terms of delivering housing supply dried up for a period of time, for several years, actually. leading into the great financial crisis, we were delivering about 1.5 million units of housing per year. Since the great financial crisis, over the last 15 years, we've delivered about 1 million housing units per year. So there's 500,000 unit shortfall of housing deliveries for a period of 15 years that effectively has led us into where we are today, which is, you know, to your first question or second question, we're short about 3 to 4 million units of housing. Now you look around your cities where you live and you see, you know, cranes and a lot of those cranes are building apartments, and there's concern that are we oversupplying apartments again? And what I would say to that is that we're still catching up from the lack of supply that was delivered over the past 15 years. And that lack of supply came at a time in context when we had the largest renter demographic, the millennial demographic, and now Gen Z entering into the ages of when they need apartments to rent, and the older, you know, cohort of the millennials needing homes to buy, and those homes and apartments are not available. And that supply and demand imbalance is what's contributing to, you know, home prices continuing to be elevated. I think if you look at, you know, the Case-Shiller index, you'd probably see that home prices are still at an all-time high. There hasn't been a correction in the single family space. And apartment rental rates are near all-time highs as well, all because of the lack of supply and the excess demand that's out there. So yes, I would agree that, you know, and even, you know, other national prognosticators, CBRE, the National Association of Realtors, they would all agree that there is a shortage of housing, despite the fact that there is a lot of supply getting delivered today. To go back to your first question, Jerry, I think the market, the investing market for multifamily, has looked at that supply and go back 18 months, 24 months from now, in addition to interest rates increasing, and that effectively increases the cost of capital, and therefore the decreases the returns on those real estates. Buyers effectively valued the real estate at a lower price. And when they valued the real estate at a lower price, they took rates into consideration and they took the supply pipeline into consideration, and in our estimation, overreacted. You mentioned Green Street had apartment values down 30%. That was as of the end of 2023. Today, they actually have apartment values down about 21 or 22% from peak. And there's a couple factors driving that. One of them being, candidly, that there was likely an overreaction to the supply that was coming into the apartment space relative to other commercial real estate sectors. And now that they're seeing that new supply is getting absorbed, they're adjusting values up. And we're seeing the same, you know, in the bidding tents when we're participating in trying to acquire multifamily communities, that those values are now higher than we would have expected 6 months ago. And I think there's a couple important news events that have driven some of that. Back in April, you had Blackstone announce an acquisition of Ayr Communities, which was a publicly traded apartment REIT. That was a $10 billion transaction. In May, you had Brookfield. Blackstone, by the way, is probably the largest real estate investment manager in the world. Brookfield's probably the second largest, or if not first. They announced a $1.5 billion acquisition of a portfolio of apartments from Starwood. And then just last month, KKR, again, another top five size real estate asset manager, announced the acquisition of a $2 billion portfolio of assets from Lennar, which is actually a home builder, but they have a multifamily arm, and they sold properties as well. And all three of those trades, they estimate, were around a 5% cap rate. And I think the market, quote unquote, believed cap rates to be in the high 5% range. These three massive trades, call it $15 billion of multifamily apartments, trading at a 5% cap rate, was positive news for the apartment world, and indicated that values are better than folks anticipated or expected, call it 6 months ago.
Well, that's excellent news if you're an apartment investor. And it part of it too, and I think I may ask this question, you know, maybe later in the show, but I wanted to go ahead and jump into it now. You've had a combination of, as you said, an overreaction to the supply. So everybody said, hey, well, you know, we're developing a million new units, not stopping to think, yeah, but how many renters are going to be in the pipeline, the demographics? You don't hear that story. You hear the story about, well, they oversupplied. Freak out. I'm like, wait a minute. There's 127 million Gen Zs and millennials coming into the stage where they're going to be renting apartments. So you can't look at only the, quote, supply and ignore the future demand. That's one issue. The second thing I think has been happening, I'd like your thoughts on this. It appears to me because rates skyrocketed so incredibly. I mean, this is the most aggressive rate hike we've seen, cycle we've seen since 1980 with Paul Volcker, in terms of how quickly they raise rates, how abruptly. Then the other part of the issue, again, to me, appears to be that when you're trying to do valuations, it's kind of like I always tell my clients, okay, if your next door neighbor loses his job in a recession and his house is foreclosed on, it affects the comps everywhere. There's been, as I understand it, and again, I want your opinion on this, a dearth of sales. People are not willing to sell right now. The only people that are selling to establish a new floor on the market value are the people that are forced to sell, the distressed sellers. They got too far out on their skis. They probably did an adjustable rate mortgage on the deal. They bought at the top of the cycle when it's what the behavioral finance calls a winner's curse. You know, the last guy in the bid pays too much for it sometimes, especially at the top of the cycle. Do you see that also affecting these valuations? Because it looks to me like a lack of transactions is masking the real picture for the long run, and they don't take into account the demographics that much. And clearly Blackstone, KKR, and the other ones look at it a little bit differently.
Yeah, for sure. So if you go back to 2023 and even the first quarter of 2024, there were almost no transactions to be seen or heard of, indicating where values were. And up until December, I think we were all questioning, would the Fed continue their rate hike cycle? I believe it was in December when Chairman Powell said, we believe we're in pause mode now. Fast forward to today, and we think, well, maybe some cuts are in the near term. Over that period of time when there were no trades, you're exactly right. It's difficult to determine what the value of your property is if there isn't a next door neighbor or even somebody in the zip code selling their property. That's what we were living through. I think the validation of all of these major institutional trades, it was really the first strong signal that you know there's safety in the water, if you will. I think you were kind of talking about, well, what's the distress scenario in multifamily and in apartments. And you're exactly right with respect to who's feeling distressed. The distressed sellers are those that bought probably in the middle of or late 2022 at the peak of values. They bought those properties with a business plan that they thought it'd come in there and maybe the project was a $50 million acquisition and they were going to spend another $5 million renovating units and renovating the property. And by doing so, they would increase rents by X percent and therefore have Y returns. They went into it thinking that, and then the rates hiked on them. They probably were borrowing floating rate debt and some sort of a bridge loan or maybe a bank loan, expecting to refinance that debt after they executed their value add program, and rates spiked on them. And now they're in a situation where they're feeling distressed. Most of those buyers bought properties that were in the lower quality segments and lower quality, what I would call tertiary markets, meaning smaller markets with lower jobs, with low job growth, or even, you know, minuscule job support, very little retail support and entertainment support for those properties. And when the rates hike on you and they dry up your cash flows, you're having a conversation with your bank. That's where the distress is being felt today. And candidly, it's not that much volume relative to the entire size of the housing sector. You think about there's, you know, 350 million people in the United States. There's, you know, there's probably 100 to 150 million housing units in the United States, you know, 99% of those people are, you know, they still have their jobs. They had decent wage growth. They, you know, they, a lot of those people borrowed during the low rates environment where they got mortgages at 3%. They're not selling their homes. They have no need to. They have no desire to. If I sell my home, I have to go get a new mortgage at 7% today. So there's very, very little distress. And just to bring it full circle back to your question, there were candidly very few trades to indicate where exactly values were up until probably the second quarter of this year.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that first part of our interview with Adam Larson of Cottonwood Communities. We will be playing more of that interview for you next week on our show. And so again, we would like to encourage you to learn more about us by going to cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. Again, you got information about us, previous radio shows and interviews, Jerry's special reports, all there on the website. And you can also call us for a free consultation at 1-800-327-4285. 1-800-327-4285. Thank you for joining us, and we hope to see you next week.
Jerry Tuma Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.